Let's start. So my academic background, I'm a computer scientist. I studied at the University of Bucharest and I did mathematics and computer science. So a lot of focus on algorithm data structure design. Early on, I was doing a lot of C, C++, assembler, MATLAB, a lot of coding. Doing, like developing file systems and all those kind of things. And also start Especially, so I start being a bit more interested in natural language processing. So again, probably coming from what our faculty was very good at, which was context-free grammars and formal languages. But as I graduated, I start being more and more interested in applied statistics and machine learning. So I looked around and I got the opportunity to study at the Max Planck Institute for Informatics, and I joined Max Planck again, very interested in doing machine learning, data mining, as we are calling it at that point. There were four groups at Max Planck, and I was looking, hey, I want to play with data, I want to do applied statistics and all that. And the only group that was very appealing was called Computational Biology and Applied Algorithmics. And this was appealing because there were basically real life problems coming from real life research that were difficult to solve. And this was early 2000, where basically was the boom of high throughput biology and generation of big genomics data sets. So I started reading some biology and I jump into doing functional biology, so doing gene expression and enrichment analysis, though I explored a lot of other areas like HIV drug resistance, secondary, tertiary prediction, docking. So we were doing some very cool things in the group there. But for me, giving the interest in statistic, I start going more towards the analysis of genomics data. So at that point, it was expression data. And I start getting into that by also being part of a quite innovative at that point course across Germany. It was called Practical DNA Microarray Analysis and was very much spearheaded by the core bioconductor team. So I'll talk a bit more about this. So I did my research there until I got stuck. So I was developing a lot of methodologies until I got stuck in interpreting the results. So I was prioritizing all these gene lists and I was like, okay, so these groups of biological function looks more relevant than this because this condition. And I was trying to understand the results. I was getting more and more and more into biology. And at that point, I said, okay, probably what I'm best at is developing those methodologies, doing analytics on the data and all this. And I'll tell you a bit. So that pushed me towards going more towards genomics. And I'll tell you in a bit about that. But in the meantime, I'll give you a bit of a, I'll start with the use case. So during my my time at Max Planck, by doing the research work in enrichment analysis and being part of the bioconductor community, and for the ones of you that don't know, bioconductor is a environment of R tools used to analyze genomics data. So it's a very coherent library of statistics, machine learning, AI tools that one can use to analyze like molecular data, life science data. So I was getting more and more involved, and I said, okay, how can I make my research usable? So I built the bioconductor package called TopGo. And at that point, I had no idea, and literally, I wasn't really looking for success. However, 13, 14 years later, I'm surprised that people are still using it. And it's basically still a very used bioconductor package. So it's top five of all the bioconductor libraries there. So not that shady. I'm still getting one or two emails every month, which shamefully I have a low latency to reply. But it's shown me that if you really try to understand what the problem is and what the community is, you can build really, really interesting products. And I take a lot of pride in this, because the package is still used after the development on it stopped, I will say 2009, 2010. So somehow I did something interesting at that point. And to be fair, over the last 5-7 years, I keep on thinking, like, how did I manage to build this? Was it a fluke or is it not? And there is another thing which somehow strike me with regard the developing this piece of software. And that was that one, the paper that backed this software got a lot of citations. And obviously now I'm not doing academic work, and this is not something that I literally like look for, but it's interesting because my supervisor at that point, York, so now he's a professor of statistics at Dartmouth University and all that. And this is still the most cited paper from him, and he's very prolific. And Thomas Langauer, which was the group leader of the computational biology group at Max Planck, it's also probably in top five, top 10. It's bettered. So there is another paper that has more citation than this for Thomas. And funny enough, that's also a software did by the colleagues of mine at Max Planck. And the cool thing is that their software is even more general. So they build, again, an R package called Rocker. That obviously is very used because it's all about REC and AUC curves. So everyone, not just life sciences, are using that kind of package. So this showed me that, you know, like, if you want to create impact, then build something useful. Cool. So as I said, after my stint at Max Planck, I moved to industry. So early 2011, got a job at Illumina in Cambridge, moving from that functional biology type of work to genomic sequencing, which I find it a bit more structured. And it was very exciting for me because I joined Illumina focusing on doing analytics and working downstream analysis of sequencing data. And it was very exciting because, you know, like I went there and all of a sudden we had very interesting data sets. So this was again early 2010s, so 2010, 2011, and we were sitting on 50 tumor normal samples, you know, whole genome sequence, 100, 150x coverage. It was like, probably there were like 3-4 places in the world having this kind of data. So obviously Cambridge, Sanger, Broad Institute and all that. So it was really, really cutting edge research. And I find it also quite interesting because I thought like we were doing hard things at Max Planck, but when I, after my first 6 months at Illumina, I realized that we were tackling more challenging problems. It was a much faster pace and we needed to, just deliver those results. So I spent probably the first year and a half at Illumina doing data analytics, and then slowly I start building towards building analytical frameworks. So what do I mean by that? So this is probably my second use case. So we start, as we were developing the instruments and developing all the sequencing technology, we start realizing, so we had a system which was called primary analysis metrics, PAM. And that was developed over like 2 or 3 years prior to me joining, and was kind of getting obsolete. And we said like, okay, so as we start sequencing more and more data, we need to be able to extract different metrics, different measurements from different at different stages of the analysis. So this was like, okay, what the machines are seeing. So those are the BCL files. So what the base color is getting there, what the file, you know, information from the FASTQs, BAMs, VCFs, and so on. So we start thinking about building this this analytical platform. So we start getting all the requirements from our colleagues in product development. So those are people doing chemistry and instrument development. And you know, like we realize, okay, we need to get on the fly analytics. There will be a lot of data there. So and services sequencing part of the business at that point was generating a lot of genomes. So we start architecting it, and from an engineering and architecting perspective, wasn't the most challenging. However, what we realized that the was really, really challenging was, okay, so we need to start, so if we want to replace the whole system, we need to start delivering actionable insights from this metric, you know, as soon as possible. So how do we do that? And we went and we start asking our colleagues, what metrics you need? And this was probably one of the first time in my career where I realized that if you want to build a product, or if you want to product being a software tool or something, if you ask your users what they need, they won't be able to articulate it, and they will tell you that they need everything. So we went to our colleagues, and they had their nice Excel spreadsheets with probably 200, 250 metrics. And we asked them, okay, so which metrics are most important for you? And if we start developing this system, what should we focus on? And the answer was clear, all of them. Right, and then we're like, okay, but to build a system to do that, it will take us, you know, like months, years. Probably it's not that easy. So we needed to kind of look a bit deeper, go back to the drawing board, and in the end, we came up with a set of I think initially was 20, 30 metrics that we believe are useful. And the interesting thing was, as we start building the call it the MVP or whatever, the prototype for this, it became being more and more used within Illumina. So this was one big lesson, which is, if you want to, don't ask your user to tell you what you have to build. However, start by building something that can actually deliver value, even if it's not the full range of features that they want. And I'll get a bit back. I'll talk about this a bit later. Okay. So the next thing. So as I was at Illumina, on one side I was focusing on building those, I would say, more large scale frameworks to serve the organization. But at the same time, I was also, you know, leveraging my involvement in the Bioconductor and the open source community. And at that point, I was seeing the impact, I was seeing the traction that TopGo was doing. So I kind of wanted to replicate that. And probably somewhere 2012, 2013, BaseSpace, which was the cloud platform that Illumina was building, started becoming more and more popular. So what I was trying to do, what I tried to do at that point was to bridge the the academic research to the offering that BaseSpace was proposing, which was, hey, there will be a lot of data that will stream from the instruments to Basebase, the cloud environment, and we build a framework to have different applications run. My idea at that point was like, well, if we build tools and infrastructure that researchers, PhD students, postdocs will be able to build applications there, then they will have access to a lot of data, and then they will also be able to improve their methodologies. So that was driving, that drove me to become an advocate of Basebase, and at the same time, trying to bridge the whatever bioconductor community, what we're doing at Illumina with Basebase, and in general, the academic community. So in the end, Basebase wasn't as successful as my other pieces of software that I developed at that point. Also, that was somehow justified by the fact that it was getting close to me moving from Illumina to my next project, which is Repositiv. So, okay, and one challenge that I realized that I encountered by spending 3.5 years at Illumina was that as we are building these things, it was we start getting more and more hurdles around access and management of genomic data. So this start becoming a bottleneck. And this was also one of the driver towards Repositiv. So meeting Fiona. Fiona joined Repositiv Illumina very much the same time with myself. So we both joined early 2011. And we start working on various projects at Illumina. And Fiona was more focused on translation, so she was trying to understand, you know, like what are the products we can build to drive, clinical application, how we can support that with our resources at Illumina. I was more the backend part of that, so developing the methodologies. You know, like all the tools, and somewhere in 2013, we realized that the bottleneck wasn't in data generation or the algorithm. So Illumina was very good at producing high quality data, and I mean, we can see today. I mean, they are the leader in the space. The algorithms weren't necessarily, the algorithms and methodology weren't necessarily rocket science. I mean, they weren't easy. And I remember when, you know, like during my stint at Illumina, we were, you know, like competing with Mike Stratton group at Sanger and, you know, development done at Broad and all those kind of things. So there was a bit of competition there, like, okay, let's find interesting methodologies to look at the data, to analyze the data, managing variant data was still a challenge at that point, mainly because, you know, we were still talking of data sets of around 100 or probably 1,000 genomes. Now this is kind of, you know, like solved by, if you think about genomic single and managing hundreds of thousands of genomes. But we realized that the problem wasn't necessarily in, as I said, quality of data or algorithm or the smartness of the algorithm, because, you know, if you have a lot of good quality data, in the end, if your method is more simple, you can get more out of it. It was more around in data interpretation, but also finding reference data sets. So, you know, like being able to ask more questions on different type of data. And that was justified Fiona to say like, hey, look, we need to do something around genomics data sharing. So she left Illumina and she started an initiative, a nonprofit called DNA Digest, with the mission of to enable ethical and efficient human genomics data sharing. So probably 9 months, 1 year later, as she was getting more and more traction, so more people supporting that idea, I also quit my job at Illumina. At that point, I was still trying to wrap up my work on Base Space and all the other initiatives I was involved in. But somewhere mid-2014, we incorporated a company called Repositive. So at Repositive, we follow the same mission as DNA Digest. So we were still interested in ethical and efficient sharing of human genomics data. But we started looking at it a bit different. So our vision was we wanted to empower the community to gain insights from the data silo. So basically we were like, well, we know that there is a lot of data produced out there. There is a lot of data that biotech pharma companies are producing. Illumina was selling a lot of reagents, so data was produced, right? So there are people that have data and there are people that need data, but they don't talk to each other. So we wanted to make it as simple as, you know, like, you know, hospitality industry, changed 20, 30 years ago. So today you can just book your hotel so easily or buy a book on Amazon. So in the beginning, we thought like, hey, look, let's build a super clever solution. At that point, we developed this this system called Privacy Preserved Query Engine, or PPQE, where we say like, look, we know that there is a lot of data behind firewalls, right? So everybody is hoarding that data. Let's develop a tool where we can start processing variant data, but in an anonymized way. So, you know, like we can, so we cared about or we were pressed to care about the privacy of the data, right? Because it's like, hey, what do you want to do with my genomic data and all those kind of things? And, you know, like we can talk forever around those things. So how can we actually compute on this data? So how we can get insights without violating those privacy? So we start developing this system, a lot of this initial work was backed by, so we got a few grants from Innovate UK, and we spent probably around 1 year developing this technology. The challenge here was that as we developed more and more and more, we realized that to get to a point where we start having this system useful, we will need way more resources and, you know, like probably a few more years. So how do we bridge this point? How do we bridge the point where we are now to where we can have this system actually working in production? So we start focusing around the metadata store. So we say like, well, if we want to do some clever analytics on genomics data, you know, under a privacy-preserving framework, we should better start understanding who has what and what the data is about. So that's how basically Repositive start growing. So what we did, we basically developed a Discover platform where we start indexing various data repositories. So at this point, we had around 40 data sources. We had more than 1 million data sets, and it was very easy to search for data, as you'll do a Google search and understand what data is there. So this was like the starting point for that. And so this threw me in a total new field, because until now, even during my time at Illumina, I was doing a lot more algorithmic design, more architecture of those, or data architecture. But at Repositive, I needed to start thinking about production-ready systems. So I start, you know, like, okay, how do you build web platforms? How do you start thinking about, you know, production-ready software? How do you think about the interplay between data governance, algorithm infrastructure? How do you how do you build strategies on how you can build clever models to extract information from the data, and you know, like how do you embed this in the loop, in the feedback loop with your from your users. So it was it took me a few, couple of years to kind of start getting to learn all those kind of thing, and you know, like putting together a team and getting used with new ways of talking about technology. Okay, so I'm not here to talk much about Repositive. Just want to give you a flavor of, you know, like some of the challenges I had along the way. So what did we manage to achieve at Repositive? And I'm giving you some highlights until end of 2018, where I exited the company. So we got a lot of support. We built a super cool team of around 30 people. Funny enough, some people in the audience are some ex-colleague of mine from Repositive, so it's nice to see. Partnerships with Pharma, AstraZeneca, BI, a couple of others. And but we also created value. So we managed to index more than 1 million data sets. We opened or whatever, we facilitated way of searching in more than 50 data repositories. We had more than 3,000 users to the platform. And just quickly, what this enabled us was to start looking and understanding some, you know, like, so doing data mining and gathering data insights from all this data that is out there. So a quick example here. So we start looking around, okay, let's see what data is out there around the personal genome. So people that did 23andMe. So we looked around, we managed to find 3,000 data sets, did some filtering, whatever, curation, ended up with around 2,000, and then start looking at them. And one of the highlights there was like, well, a lot of those genomes come predominantly from European population, right? So all this technology we developed, right, highlighted the, you know, like the potential of, you know, assembling very interesting data sets, call them synthetic data sets. And, you know, like it also showed us that there is a lot of information you can get from the data. So here is like, we understood that, you know, like there is a huge bias in these demographics. Okay, so I think I have less than 10 minutes.
That's okay. I mean, like, we are not here to count exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So going beyond genomics. So as I said, I exited the company in 2018. And this was very much driven by the fact that I started getting more and more interested in the intersection of digital technologies, life sciences, healthcare, data science. So happened over the last couple of years, basically, I start working with other early stage ventures, young entrepreneurs, very much driven by the fact that while I was building the product and tech at Repositive, and I was talking to these people, I realized that everyone was having the same challenges. How do you build product? How do you build a team? How do you go fundraise and whatever? A lot of things probably outside the scope of this discussion. So, I start spending more and more time talking to them and trying to help them and trying to share some of my, let's call them war scars. More recently, from the beginning of the year, I also start doing VC investments, so going on the other side of the table and basically trying to support new products and new companies being created from the funding side. And at the same time, I'm also working on a couple of projects in the health tech space. People call them stealth, which means like we still have no idea what the product will be there. But yeah, so just to give you a flavor, what I mean by beyond genomics. So I'm working with companies in preventive health, and you can think of this physical health, mental health, people tackling diseases like Parkinson's, diabetes, well-being in general, aging, big topic, really interested in people that are building data-driven platforms, fertility and reproductive health. So I have, I worked with a couple of projects where you start really seeing very interesting diagnostics and therapeutics being developed there. Mobility and wearable, but also work with some companies on that, probably go outside the life science. So things like sustainability or youth empowerment. So helping youth better manage, various integration challenges and all those kind of things. Again, very much from a technology perspective. So medical or health data, one quick example I want to give here, and I won't spend that much time. 1 year ago, I started working with this company that they operate in the insurance, health insurance space, and it's all about enhancing medical briefs. So basically, they start building a platform where they need to start process medical information and they need to produce highly organized, navigable search. So these medical briefs, think about, EMRs, but, also other claims type of data put together. So you kind of end up compiling a 2,000-page JPEG PDF. So, it's pictures, right? You can put them in a PDF and it sounds like a PDF, but in the end, you can't search through it. So it's pretty chunky piece of document. And the industry is very much pen and paper at this point. So, you will have some clinicians that needs to assess these documents getting either printed, so an envelope with printed documents, or they get this PDF, but they need to go through this PDF and say, and I'll figure out where a particular piece of information is. So when did you do an eye test, or, what kind of analysis you did and all those kind of things. So this company called Bear Health Technology, very Canadian name, so they're Canadian. They start building this software. And it was really, really fascinating because they really had an understanding of the business. They didn't, of the industry, they didn't really have a good understanding of the tech, of the engineering. So they start making the assumption that they can build the tech in 6 months or something like that. And obviously it was very difficult because you need to start OCRing these documents. These documents are so heterogeneous, even if you have good OCR, the information is, they are tilted. It's very, very, very challenging, even that step alone. But then you need semantic technology to understand what these doctors are talking about. You need to manage images. Really, really challenging. And what we did was, to break the problem in small bits, obviously I can't really fully go in detail. And the first product we built there was very, very simple. Was okay, can we go from a document to a table of contents? So we built it a table of content, hyperlinked table of content. So you can kind of see in the image here. So if you think about, if you get this 1,000-page document and you see medical brief, and you say first document starts page one, ends at page five, then we extracted a few metadata, 3-4 metadata fields, and we start doing this semi-automatically. The cool thing about this was that people start paying for it because it was so much easier to use this hyperlink table of content than just doing it themselves. And over time, they start, including things like page duplication, extracting more information, searching through those kind of thing. But a lot of those things kind of take time. Okay, so what am I talking about here? One of the the biggest challenge I see, or most common challenge I see, is that in general, people are trying to build everything at once, right? And that's what I'm kind of trying to say with these use cases. Try to focus on some very achievable things. And this is, I didn't create this slide, so I think it's an Australian guy called created this slide, which, when you talk about product and, you know, like all these startup, lean startup people will talk about minimum viable product, call it prototype, call it, you know, like proof of concept. I did this, I fall into this trap so many times. You start by thinking like, hey, I have a piece of technology, or I want to solve a problem. And in order for my problem to be, or for my product to be useful, I need to solve, or I need to, you know, like think about a lot of features, a lot of functionality. Yes, you have to think about those things, but you need to discipline yourself to start thinking about how you can build a slice across all this value proposition, rather than building one layer at a time. And again, this is very much design kind of language, but you can apply it to, you know, like if you build a software library, or if you build a physical product, or if you build whatever product you will build, you still need to think about the functional thing. You still need to think about, you know, like, is it buggy? How reliable will it break in people's hand? Is it usable? Can actually people use it? And emotional design does people really, really attach to it, really love it. And I like talking a lot about these things, because it's not about, my experience and the use cases I showed until now. For example, the last one with Bear, in the beginning, the company wanted to build, we need this functionality and this functionality and this functionality and this functionality and this one. In the end, we start by saying like, hey, look, if we build hyperlink table of content, and then we start adding functionality, we'll be able to first understand what the user wants, what they like, and we, you know, like we'll learn, we'll accumulate data, right? So at Bear, they now sit on, I think, hundreds of thousands of medical briefs. So, I mean, they really have a big data challenge there. How can we, you know, like extract this information, which was very difficult 1.5 years ago when they started, because they had nothing, right? So if you think about building one slice at a time, you really put yourself in the driving seat. And just a bit, I'm almost finished. One way to think about this, you know, like how can you build something useful, impactful, or how can you generate this product market fit? So what I learned over the time is, you know, if you're in industry, you start very much with the business needs, you know, like what does, you know, like who does actually, you know, is there a problem there? Rather than me trying to convince people that is a problem, is there a problem? Can I actually use my knowledge, know-how, technology to solve it? So is there a problem? What will be a good product to solve that problem? What technology, what engineering I need to do that? And, you know, like, okay, so we don't have technology to manage variant data. So now let's start doing some research and understanding, you know, like, can we compress this genomic data? But it needs to be driven by the business need. Whereas in academia, I remember, again, when I was at Max Planck, and I think, you know, like probably that's what CATS it's trying to enable, for people to think more translational. So in academia, you start from a fundamental research problem. If you build some successful research there, then you're thinking about, okay, how can I build some cool tools around that thing? That's basically what I did with my TopGo package. And then I was lucky enough to have a product and, you know, like people need it. There are very few cases where you can build successful products like this. And, you know, like you can also think about companies. I think a company that successfully managed to pull this way of developing product or finding product market fit will be DeepMind, because they start by, you know, really thinking, oh, what, you know, like how can we solve this problem? They build a very strong team of researchers and they build the tech that many of us are using today. And then they build a product. Probably they still looking for this product needs. Cool. So I'm done. How can I help? Well, how can I help you? Hopefully. If you start thinking about, oh, how do I combine the tech I have with, you know, like understanding the user, understanding the customer. So think customer user, how can I really design this impactful product? We can have very interesting conversations. If you need to think about your product tech stack, so if you have some Python R, MATLAB, or any other type of code, so tools that you developed, and of course, those are, you start with a script or even, you know, Excel spreadsheet, and you want to think about wrapping this into web apps or production code, or, you know, like including them in other other bigger tools, let's have a chat then. Grant application, I'm not a great grant writer, but we can definitely have conversations around, you know, like, hey, look, what are the, you know, if I need to develop some software, if I need to put together a data strategy there, if I need to create these work packages around this, how can I do it? I can ask you the difficult questions, how is this useful, and all those kind of things. Translation of data science and, you know, AI ML methodologies, and stakeholder management. As you start getting involved in more and more projects where you really need to deliver value to patients, then there are obviously more stakeholders involved. And I did this over the last 5-7 years. So, yeah. Thank you. That's me. Hopefully now you have a better understanding of what I did and why I'm here. And I leave it here.